All right, Beyonders, welcome back to Tabletop and Beyond. We have the crew back together, reunited, and it feels so good.
Together again, like the Muppets.
Exactly. Jason, welcome back. Dan, welcome back. It's nice to have you guys here with us together again. So
it's good to be here with you today, Justin.
I know.
Can I be Dr. Teeth for the Muppets? Well, all right!
I'll be Animal.
Yeah, exactly. Be Animal. I'll be Beaker. Beep, 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 beep. Yeah. Yeah. All right. I was always a Fozzie guy, you know, waka waka.
Hey!
So, yeah.
Waka waka. Honestly, you think you are, Fozzie.
Here's a funny story. I had a video when I was like, I don't know, 9 years old, and it was like, you're as funny as Fozzie Bear, and it was a video that taught you jokes and magic tricks, just like Fozzie Bear. And so I watched this video, it was a VHS tape, yep, and I watched this video multiple times, I learned the jokes, learned the magic tricks, and I performed them for people, anybody who was interested in it. And I always ended it with Waka Waka! So, yeah. And I was at that moment as funny as Fozzie Bear. So
I'm sure.
And now you're as fuzzy as Fozzie Bear.
Exactly. That's true too. That's very true. Well, we have a good show for you guys today. We're talking about card games, but not just any card games. We're talking to you about living card games and what the difference is between collectibles and non-collectibles and all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be fun. It's going to be awesome. But first, of course, we always get started with Geek Week. Dan, kick us off with your Geek Week.
Man, I have not been geeking very much at all. When you're in the middle of a kitchen remodel, geek goes away real fast. But I did order something 2 months ago that finally showed up in the mail. I ordered a specialized neoprene mat with the sewed edges for Outer Rim. If you guys know Outer Rim, it's kind of fussy. There's lots of card decks and the board shape is, you know, a half circle and you can put everything out there. And I got it on Etsy. It came from Poland. Are these a good deal? No mat is a good deal. No neoprene mat. You never walk away feeling like you got a steal. So, they do a nice job. Apparently in Eastern Europe is where most of these things get printed for some unknown reason. But it's really high quality. I'm looking forward to playing. It also fits into my theory of buy the accoutrement for the games that you're actually playing, not games that you want to play. There's nothing like having a shelf full of expansions and accoutrement that never see the light of day. So I have a buddy who lives a few doors down from me who calls me and says, let's just play Outer Rim real quick. Okay, all right. 4 hours later, we get a game in. So.
Yeah,
which, you know, that is a game that I think absolutely needs a mat, just because of like it keeps things in their proper place and proper, you know, order very well. And again, if you're playing it, like it's worth it. It's worth it.
Yeah,
you're gonna get use out of it for sure.
I know I will. Yeah, I feel really comfortable with it, and we put a lot of miles on that game, and we keep having fun with it. We keep not wanting to put it away, which is sad, but at least that's one board game I can get to the table. I've got somebody willing to play on a regular basis. Geek Week number two, I think on Sunday I watched Damsel with Millie Bobby Brown on Netflix. My wife woke me up from my Sunday nap with a dragon princess movie, and it was really well done, and I liked it a lot. And I realized Millie Bobby Brown has a lot in common with Harrison Ford because watch Damsel. She really feels the pain. It's like Indiana Jones takes a punch and Harrison Ford sells every micro ounce of pain he receives. Harrison Ford is selling that on the screen. And I think Millie and Harrison have been hanging out because she is in agony for 2 hours. It's very believable agony.
Fair enough. So
Damsel, it's about the princess who does not get saved from the dragon. So,
here's an interesting little tidbit. I read over the weekend that Taylor Swift released her Eras Tour on Disney Plus, right?
Yes, it broke the internet.
Yep, well, kind of. Here it is, kind of. They got about somewhere like 35 million downloads in the weekend, watches of it. Now, Damsel got almost 100 million downloads.
Oh, really?
Think about that. Is they were talking about how Disney Plus may not have the reach that a lot of people think it does. That if, like, for example, Taylor Swift would have been on Eras, she probably would have gotten 200 million downloads.
You mean Netflix?
Sorry, on Netflix. Yeah. We're on Netflix, you probably would have gotten 200 million downloads. And so they're saying that basically, you know, a lot of pundits have counted Netflix out, you know, that they said, oh, Netflix isn't like what it used to be, which might be true because like a lot of networks have pulled their best shows and put it on their own streaming platforms. But Netflix is still a major player there. And they were saying that basically the Taylor Swift versus Damsel thing kind of showed how that really was.
Yeah, and so. Nobody Damsel didn't get the nearly the news that Taylor got. So
right, yeah. So interesting tidbit.
Yeah, I recommend the film. I liked it, and it was just on my streaming service, and my wife made me watch it, and then I liked it. So it's good.
Awesome, Jason. How was your geek week?
I spent most of my time working on trying to finalize my card game.
Yeah.
That I've been making. So I'll share my screen to give a oh, that's right, you always get the warning if you share your screen, everyone will see your screen. Yes, that's why I'm clicking share my screen. So here's some of the art for my card game that I've made. This is all my own art. All right, so that's
no AI involved.
No AI involved at all.
Unless you want to call Jason AI, and I mean that might make sense.
Yeah, well there is there is a neural network. It's just a wet one up here that's doing it.
Jason,
so this
Jason's fingers are a little weird too. So, you know, AI.
What? Okay. So this is my, this is one of the examples of my card, right? A decoy there. So, which is actually the graphic behind on the back of my ship and assets card. And Justin, you had a good idea. I really liked your idea of just making the backs of the cards really simple and giving them kind of that, you know, that eclectic, dark, deep space feel there. There's the back of my planet cards. Just simplify them. But I'm really happy with the art here and the way that it's turned out. You know, I'm really excited to get this thing out to print. I think it's fun. I play tested it with several people. And, I had a goal this year. One of our New Year's resolutions was to actually do it, actually make a game. And this is an easy one that I can get out the door. And so now I'm just running it through a couple different print shops, getting quotes to get it printed at low quantity, you know, because I'm sure there's going to be something that we want to tweak or change when we play test it some more. Once we get it on the actual table, we'll go from there. But anyway, so that was the majority of my geek week.
And then the next thing, Jason, is that you're going to end up like demoing at Gen Con for like 8-hour stints.
Yeah. Right? I think so. I think I'm gonna get like six. I'm debating on either three or six decks. It's one of those like you hit bulk pricing right at five. So it's actually cheaper to get six decks than it is five decks, even with shipping. But it's just whether or not I actually want to pay, you know, another 80, because at low quantity you're paying like 30. This is about a 100 card deck, and it's about $30 a deck at low quantities for a nice quality card. I could go with a really crappy card that will tear like after you play it like five or six times for cheap, but I don't want to do that. So, so it's been a learning experience. Learning how to use tools like this is Affinity Publisher that I've used to create the art, right? So different layers, and learning about like the bleed lines and the cut lines to make sure that you give, you know, room for the bleed edge and the cut edge from the manufacturer shop. They give out really nice templates that kind of run through that, what the bleed area is, the cut area, and then the safe area for your text. So this is one of the websites that kind of gives out those templates. So been a fun progress on that. Yep.
I'm buying one. Awesome. I'm buying one from you as soon as you get the first batch.
Yeah.
I got dibs.
Yeah, we'll I'll definitely give you, you know, I'm going to buy the first batch and just give them out for people to play and test. So we'll do some play testing. And then if there's enough time, if I feel like there's, I think I'm going to get six just so that I can go to Gen Con with those six, even if there's tweaks, you know. But if there's enough time after some play testing, I'll try to do another run before Gen Con just to get it up there. But it'd be cool. You know, the quantities, bulk pricing is crazy in that industry. Like,
yeah,
you know, one to five decks is like anywhere you go, it's going to be somewhere around $15 to $30, depending on the quality of card you want. If you get up to like 1,000 decks, it's like $1 a deck for 100 cards. Yeah. It's crazy, like how much it really drops in price. So, you know,
determined a name for your game?
Not yet, which is why this first run is, I'm not doing a box or anything. It's just shrink wrap cards, you know, because I haven't figured it out yet. I think I need to get some more play time on the table. Okay. What?
Moonrakers. Oh, wait a minute.
Wait.
Yeah.
Moon blowers. Moon baggers. Moon mowers.
Baggers. Moon baggers. Oh, God. Planet baggers. Yeah. Yeah. I'm
just kidding. Yeah. Should we?
How you win.
While we're at Gen Con, should we get you some interviews with some publishers?
They have that playtest lobby area where people can bring their games. But I looked into that last year, and it was like you had to pay like $300 to get a table in there.
Ugh.
I don't know if it's changed or not, but years ago it used to be that you could just kind of go and show up. But then I don't know if they started charging for a reason or not, but.
Yeah, well, otherwise, you know, I'm sure we could get you an interview with the disgraced Mythic guys.
Yeah.
You could be the thing that brings Mythic back from the brink.
This is it. Yeah.
Moonbaggers. Moonbaggers will bring you back. Moonbaggers.
Yeah. Hey, you got to try my game, Moonbaggers. Anyway, last thing I did. Here, let me. I stopped sharing. Okay, good. The last thing I did for my Geek Week was this Sunday night. It was spring break. Actually, last night, Monday night, my wife said, hey, let's all watch a movie as a family. So we sat down and watched Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. So it's interesting, Dan, you brought up Indiana there. But, man, you know, just what a great movie. The chemistry between all of the actors in that movie, like Sean Connery and Harrison Ford have such great chemistry as father-son in that movie. It's just such a great watch.
That is a movie that holds up.
It held up so well.
That's a third movie in a trilogy that is like, that's like when everybody says, oh, by the time you get to the third movie in the trilogy, the third's usually kind of a dud. It's like, no, that one is. That one
amazing.
Kept the entire franchise alive for many, many, many years.
Yeah. And it's funny, like if we sat down and said, hey, let's walk through The Last Crusade, we could probably describe that entire movie from start to finish. But if you asked me to do the same thing for Crystal Skull or even the last one, I'm like, I can't remember anything. Yeah, what happened? Movies.
Dude, I haven't even seen the last one yet.
So like, the last one,
I should, but
yeah,
I just haven't yet.
The last one was actually, I don't really remember much about it, but I enjoyed it. My wife and I walked out thinking that felt like an old Indiana Jones movie.
Yeah.
It felt like a close to The Last Crusade. Not quite there, but close to The Last Crusade. But The Last Crusade is just so memorable, like all of the parts of it. Such a good movie.
Yeah, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge is really good in the last one too.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's really great.
Yeah. All right, what about you, Justin?
All right, so I got two things. The first one I'm going to bring up right now is that I started and finished the Graveyards of Arkham actual play done by Chaosium. And Dan, did you ever listen to the Bookshops of Arkham?
I'm behind, but I want to. Okay,
but you had listened to part of it, right?
Yeah. Snippets.
Yeah. Graveyards of Arkham did not disappoint. It was so good. Like, and it got good. I thought that Bookshops was a little bit better. But listen, it was kind of like a 1-2 type of thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they're both super high quality. And I think I mentioned this before. I am not normally a fan of actual play. Like, I really, I have a hard time sitting down and watching people do actual play. Some people were totally into that. Like, they love Critical Role. They love some of these other ones that are out there. And Chaosium even has like a whole bunch of actual play podcasts that are out there. But this is different. This is like they're all in the studio together. These are voice and actors. I mean, they're not just voice actors, but there are also actors that play these parts. And they've got the Roll20 system that's integrated into these little iPads that they have that they use. And so when they do it, they just kind of click a button and it rolls the dice for them and it tells them if they succeed. So they're not sitting there going like, I rolled a 78. Is that a success or a failure? Or it's just like, I pass, I hard success. Like, they just kind of know and roll with it, and they do a great job. Mark Meer, who is pictured here, again, we've mentioned his name. He's the voice of Commander Shepard in Mass Effect, and he's done a whole bunch of different voice acting as well. He is phenomenal. I think he absolutely carries this series, and it's just so good. It's one of those things that it's like, I listen to the first episode and I find myself wanting to continue to listen and just like get back to it. And it's like picking up a good book, right? All the people are totally committed to the characters. They bring some fun NPCs in there that are like acting, and they have some great twists in here. It's very, very HP Lovecraftian, you know, I mean, just very, very Cthulhu. So it was great. And because I was listening to all of this and I was like super focused on it, I got a lot of painting done. Like, a lot of painting. I ended up finishing like 3 warbands in a week.
Wow.
Which is pretty amazing. Like, I got a lot of stuff done. But I mean, I had my phone kind of sitting there and it was playing, and I didn't have to sit there and watch it the whole time. I could listen to it as I was painting and get the full effect. And it was a lot of fun. So if you find yourself commuting, if you find yourself, you know, doing menial tasks or something like that, like, this is so good to just pull up and dive into. So highly recommend it. I'm going to see if we can get some folks on to talk about this, because the other thing that is, a lot of this was written using the guide to, it's a Call of Cthulhu Arkham book. And it is the definitive guide to Arkham. I mean, it's a, you know, it's an amazing book. It has, you know, it's like 250 plus pages of just like NPCs in here, locations, descriptions. You've got like plot hooks that you could take and run. I mean, if you're looking up like, the person of who's the owner of the inn, like, you could reference that super fast, and they've got like a little backstory and all that stuff. And just really, really, really awesome book. So they used this book to help write this Graveyards of Arkham. And so I think maybe we'll get somebody on to talk about both of them, because they kind of go hand in hand. So very cool.
Justin, you may not know this, but we once did an entire episode about Graveyards in Arkham. I don't know.
We talked about, because
it was the Kickstarter. I know. I'm messing with you. Yeah.
So just, we talked about bookshops and graveyards and all that. But yeah, it was a good episode.
You could go get your own plot of dirt in
that's
fictional
right.
Arkham, your own grave plot.
Your own graveyard plot, exactly. My other Geek Week thing was kind of interesting. So one of my New Year's goals was to write my own RPG and try to get it published, right? And I didn't commit to getting it published, just because, like, there's a lot of things that happen with publishing and timing and all that stuff. But writing it was, like, the main goal and getting it ready. So my plan, and I feel safe to talk about this now because of what has kind of happened, but my plan was to write an X-Files RPG that was focused on modern day X-Files, government conspiracies, aliens, supernatural phenomenon, the whole shebang, right? And I've been watching X-Files a lot with my daughter recently, and there's just so much to pull from in that and play with as an RPG. I don't think a lot of IPs are totally like one for one with an RPG, but I think X-Files fits like amazingly. You can do some great stuff.
They've got big arcs, but also cool episodes, cool standalone episodes.
Yeah, which is like a great formula for campaigns and, you know, and things. So Anyway, I reached out to Disney, and they politely but firmly rejected my request to secure the license for the X-Files.
What?
And what? Yeah, I know, Disney? Exactly.
They said, no, little people, go away.
Yeah, go away, little person. We have no idea who you are, right? And so I said, all right, well, what's next? And I actually reached out to Thomas Crowell, who was on our show a little while ago to talk about copyright law and AI and all that. And I decided to sit down with him for about an hour to talk about, okay, well, what can I do then? What can I do to make this an X-Files RPG without making it an X-Files RPG? And he basically said, well, you can try to get somebody more famous than you to try to go ask, you know, like a J.J. Abrams or somebody like that. And I said, well, I don't know. I don't know that many famous people. He's like, okay, well, then he says, you know, then you're stuck kind of doing your own thing. And you can go get an IP from like the 1920s, you know, like a like an Aleister Crowley's secret agency or something like that.
One of those that isn't covered anymore.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, it's over 100 years old. And I said, well, I want to kind of keep this modern because that's part of the fun of this is like the modern government conspiracy theories that we have, right? Like, and stuff like that. And in the 1920s, the government wasn't as like conspiratorial as it is now, right? And sure? So, yeah, yeah, as far as I know.
We've gotten anyway, more conspiratorial.
Yeah, exactly. So, I decided to go my own route. So basically I need to like scrub my RPG of any references to X-Files, and which actually is easier than you think. Because he said, once you get away from the names, once you get away from, you know, Mulder and Scully, then pretty much all of it's fair game. You know, working out of the FBI, fair game. Investigative services, fair game. Monsters, aliens, like all sorts of like, you know, folklore stuff, fair game. Like it's all fair game.
Fair game.
Like what you can't do is you can't say like, okay, well, I have a FBI agent who's a red-haired, you know, doctor named Schmoly, and a, you know, and another FBI agent who's tall, dark, and handsome, and who had a sister who was abducted when he was 12 named Schmolder. And, you know, like, I can't get that close. I can't call it, like, the P-Files or, you know, the W-Files or something
that. Wait, what is the boundary?
The P-Files is about what we do now late at night.
Right, exactly.
All the time to go to the bathroom now that we're middle-aged men. Sorry.
So, basically, I mean, the thing is I can't be, like, too tongue-in-cheek that it's, like, obviously referencing the X-Files. You know what I mean?
But you could... if the whole thing was a satire.
True. That would be an interesting RPG if it was all satire. Because
Men in Black.
Yeah.
Yeah, then you're doing Men in Black. So anyway, so what I have decided is I am going to start... I have started writing my RPG. It's still going to be very X-Files heavily inspired. That's how I have to say this now, according to legal advice. It is inspired by the X-Files. And other things like, you know, H.P. Lovecraft and, you know, Twilight Zone and, you know, all of those, you know, Fringe, etc. Like all of those other things. It's inspired by many things. And X-Files is just
call it like Area 51. That's a government name.
Totally. I think I'm going to call it Paranormal. Because I think what I'm going to do is the story behind it is that you find yourself now working in the paranormal division of the FBI, which has been stood up by some secret funding, you know, kind of off the register funding that Congress has given you due to all of the recent alien hearings that have been happening. You know, so they wanted to investigate these paranormal phenomena more. So they have set up a paranormal division within the FBI. So so I'm going to call it Paranormal, I think. And, but I've already started, writing a lot of it. And I think we've got some really cool mechanics coming out of it that set it apart as like a very good investigative, RPG that still has a lot of like role play and action in it. Cause I think you can, with an investigative RPG, you can like go way too heavy on the investigation.
Yeah, it can get real scalpel-y and not hatchety.
Yep. So, and I want to keep it hatchety because I think that's where the fun is.
Yeah.
You know, so Anyway,
which matches more... the genre. The genre has to be done. You got to be done with an episode in an hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not an RPG session, but
right.
You have
right,
to hit right, those, right. those moments.
Yep. Yep. 100%. So, yeah, I mean, more to come on that, but I have been plugging away on that the last couple of nights and really kind of making some good progress. So I'm hoping to have like a good solid rough draft in the next week or two. And I think I want to start play testing some elements of it.
Wow.
Which streamer is it spells on?
Yeah. What's that, Dan?
Of the whole thing in the next week or two?
Yeah, I think I'll have. I mean, there's going to be some of the background fluff that I don't need in there to like play test that I need to still write. But like
that's true. The mechanics, some mechanics.
Yeah, I think I'll have all the mechanics fleshed out in the next week or two.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So yeah. Sorry, Dan, you're saying something.
Is it is X Files on Hulu or which?
Disney Plus, believe it or
Disney
not.
Disney Plus has X Files. Okay, cool.
Yep. Yep. So because they are part of 20th Century Fox.
Yep.
That was acquired by them in 2019. So yeah, so check. And by the way, I've been watching a lot of X-Files lately. Season 2 has some banger episodes. I mean, some like absolute gems that are just so good. So good. And I got my 17-year-old watching with me, and she's just like, dang, this was a good episode. You know, and she's not into like horror normally. Actually, she thinks about it too long and too much and freaks herself out. But these ones, she's just like, yeah, these are really good. So yeah, some absolute bangers. So anyway, that's my geek week. That's what we got. So I think that we are now moving on to our geek news.
Yeah.
Welcome to Tabletop and Beyond News. My own brother told me he was embarrassed for me with a slapdash way I do the news every time I'm on the show. It's like, I'm embarrassed for you. I'm like, that feels good. Thanks, buddy. Shout out to Nate. This is news that I find super interesting. And it's not all, sometimes I do a little too much RPG news. This is news coming out of Adepticon. The Fifth Trooper had posted what Atomic Mass Games had put out for the rest of 2024 and 25. They've got a print schedule. There'll be some range troopers. Those were the heavily white-furred troopers in Solo, the ones that they fought while they were doing the train heist. So the Imperials are getting range troopers. The Republic is getting clone commandos from the old video game Republic Commando. So that's going to be pretty sweet for them. The Republic is also getting the Bad Batch. And the Bad Batch can also work for the Rebellion, apparently, which is going to be a very unique game mechanic.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Yep.
All those high point guys into a squad. Mm-hmm. It'll be like usually an operative is a single guy like a Jedi, but now this will fill the operative slot in the army builder sequence. But you'll be able to bring in as many of those Bad Batch characters as you want to have points for. So that's interesting, cool. Interesting stuff.
I love that series. That Bad Batch series is so good.
Yeah, and I'm a little behind on it, but I do like it, and it's doing great. The Rebels are getting a sleeper cell, which is interesting, and the Empire is getting a riot control squad, so stormtroopers with shields and melee, and some of the K2SO type droids from Rogue One. The Separatists are getting crab droids. That'll be cool. They've got some terrain that's coming out later. Aqua droids. I don't know how they're going to do aqua droids in this game because it's a land-based game, not a water-based game. ARF troopers. They kind of look like a cross between clone troopers and scout troopers. And that'll introduce generic Jedis. If you scroll down just a little bit, you'll see they've got the
ARF troopers have like those old British safari hats.
Yeah, they look, they're kind of like scout. They have the weird little brims on their helmets,
yeah.
Like the scout troopers from Return of the Jedi. They're going to re-sculpt All of the soft plastic. When Legion first came out, it was done in soft plastic, not hard plastic, not hard PVC. And so there was a lot of resculpting they're going to be doing over the next year of re-releasing most of the old sets, and they're going to be doing new sculpts, and it's going to look cool and catch up their old stock. So they're really supporting the old game. I mean, all of the old products, they're re-releasing the old products, which is a really good sign. They have a lot of faith in the game, and this is a really healthy release schedule for the next 2 years. I'm kind of pissed that there's not a single bit of Shadow Collective on there, because I like playing the Shadow Collective, and there's none of that. So I feel like they've taken the fifth faction, and it was already pretty anemic, and they're kind of ignoring it, which is hurtful. My feelings are hurt. But, and you'll notice that there's a lot of Republic-focused stuff. So this tends to, feels like a game now where one faction is going to get like 90% of the love. Which kind of gets on my nerves just a little teeny it tiny happens. Bit.
It's cyclical. I'll tell you what, though, looking at this timeline right here, this is exactly what fans of the game always want to see.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even matter what's on here. Like, I'm sure they're excited about what's on there. It's the fact that they are saying, like, hey, we're supporting this at least for the next 2 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, like, we've got this roadmap. And I know that, like, when Age of Sigmar or Warcry would put out, you know, like, hey, here's our roadmap. This is like we're planning to release a box like in fall of, you know, 2024, and then like two other things, like two other factions in spring of 2025. Like when people see that, like, it gives them like faith and confidence in the game that they're playing and excitement too, right? So
yeah,
it just makes it feel like a living game.
And having them reprinting older products. In you know, in new plastic, new sculpts is just another way of saying they want to put a bunch more years on the odometer for Star Wars Legion. So that's great.
And those original ones were printed from Fantasy Flight Games, is that right?
Yeah.
And now these ones are Atomic Mass Games, which, I mean, obviously use a different printing method for their stuff, because it's
yes, because they were doing the little soft plastic. Each guy came in a little teeny plastic bag, and now it's like a modern mini game where you pop everything off the sprue, and you can use plastic cement instead of super glue to put it together. It's been like that for a good little while, but they're taking the old stuff and bringing it up to
snuff. Yeah, those PVC ones, especially the lightsabers, they get a little less.
They get a little
more flaccid.
They get flaccid, legit flaccid. Yeah. No, we had that problem with the soft plastic for Wizards of the Coast when they had the minis license. They came pre-painted, and the lightsabers were great because they were translucent plastic. But I swear, 50% of them needed the hot water, cold water bath to get them to straighten out. And it was, I had many, we spent a lot of time dunking minis in hot water and cold water, kind of like a mini sauna, hot then cold, you know?
That's right.
So yeah. In other news, I got two more items of news that have to do with D&D going more mainstream than it already was. There will be D&D Lego sets, Dungeons and Dragons Lego sets coming out, and they look kind of cool. You got owlbears and trolls and dwarves and taverns and Lego already has a wide variety of dragons in their stables. Mm-hmm. My son has about 7 different Lego dragons in his room at this moment. Between Ninjago and the other properties they have. So, but that's cool that Lego and Hasbro are teaming up and getting more D&D product out there. And teaming up with Lego is a pretty big deal.
I think there's an interesting Venn diagram intersection here, because you know that there's a lot of dudes that and ladies, I'm just saying dudes in general, right? Like people that love Legos and love D&D. So This might be a peanut butter jelly situation here.
Yeah. It's kind of a win-win. I knew back in the day when Lego first started coming out with unique sets, they had castles and knights and horses. And I knew a lot of D&D players back in the 80s that invested heavily in that. So it's kind, in some way, it's kind of coming full circle in a way.
And now you can use them, you know, as your minis. Like you can just use your Lego guys.
You know? You sure can, which I'm a fan. I think it's great.
My wife's a big a Lego fan. She's got a bunch of huge box sets. Like, you know, she actually has the Indiana Jones Temple of Doom set, which is amazing. Wow. It's got a bunch of like mechanical stuff that runs, like the ball rolls and everything. And like when you pull the idol, like the whole thing caves in and the idol sinks down. It's really cool. I'm looking over at it, but she builds a ton of Legos. My problem with Legos is, they're one of those things that always feels like it's a little bit too much money. Like, yeah. I look at a Lego box, yeah. I'm like, yeah, that's cool. That should be like $20, and it's $32.
Yeah.
Or that's a lot of stuff. I could see that being like $100, and it's like $172.
Yeah.
Or like $132. It's like just a little bit more for me to be like, oh, I'm going to think about that one a little bit longer.
I built a desk that I did work on in my old townhouse. That is my son's Lego table. It is covered. Every square inch of this double wide desk is pure Lego. So I feel you, Jason. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's just, trust me.
My latest project, or my wife's latest project, is Rivendell.
Oh, nice.
She has that box set, which is that was an expensive, that was like her Christmas gift, but, she's been burrowing through that, but there's so much opportunity for Lego to endure for like the next, you know, 50 to 100 years of mankind and still stay relevant.
Exactly.
It's so easy to tap into fan bases with Legos.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
Yep.
I mean, essentially, Legos is just a medium. It's just a medium to bring in other IPs. You know, because you can have Lego Star Wars, Lego Lord of the Rings, Lego D&D, Lego, like, whatever. They're just like, yeah, hey, we're just the building blocks of your childhood memories and even adult memories, you know? So, yeah, pretty cool. Right on.
Yeah, sounds good. Cool stuff. The last item is that Converse, the tennis shoe guys, are debuting 4 D&D inspired high tops and some additional apparel, including some hats and stuff. So this is pretty mainstreamifying of D&D when you can buy D&D boxer shorts from Converse, as well as have a cool pair of high tops. And some of these designs are pretty retro from, you know, old school D&D, which I'm kind of a fan of. So this is all part of the 50th anniversary stuff that is being associated with the game. So anyway, pretty cool. I think the designer is Chuck Hardy, if I'm not mistaken. I am not a person who pays attention to that kind of thing, but for those out there, I think they look cool. I like them. I'll give them a thumbs up. I think they're cool. I don't know if my old man plantar fasciitis could handle a pair of Converse, but if I get my custom orthotics in them, I could be a cool D&D kid. Back in the day, we just used a marker and wrote on our Converse.
So don't go too far down there.
Yeah, I know, right? Yikes.
Don't go to the bottom of Polygon. Yeah.
Polygon, scary.
Yeah.
You know?
Thanks, Polygon.
So yeah, listen, if you wear these, don't crease them, right? Don't crease them.
Oh, he's folding them down because you'd be
So
yeah, it even on the back of the heel it says Dungeons and Dragons instead of Converse, which I think is kind of cool that they would cede that real estate to the other logo. Anyway, it's just one more weird way that geek culture is ever expanding into mainstream culture in very strange ways.
So let me ask you this. Do you think that we are peaking right now in terms of D&D? Like, I mean, they've reached like the sneakerheads at this point. You know what I mean? D&D has reached the sneakerheads. Like, are we peaking right now? Are we going to start to see kind of the, like we've seen the flow. Are we going to see the ebb come for D&D where it's like things would get kind of pulled back and be like, yeah, that was fun. I remember Stranger Things and that was fun, but you know, now we're just not into that anymore.
So do you want a pessimistic answer or an optimistic answer? And I think what are you fishing for?
I want an honest answer.
I want a Dan's opinion answer. What are you, optimistic or pessimistic about this, Dan?
Dananistic.
I'll come down on optimistic. I think that certain fandoms increase exponentially over time. Either they flat and they never take off, or they take off and they go up the hockey stick curve. And even if they level out, mm-hmm. they'll just still be around. And then someone will come and rediscover them later. So, yeah, we thought G.I. Joe and Transformers were dead, and there's plenty of that around. So
they came out with some terrible movies.
Bad movies that keeps fandom alive. There's still product being sold. So, I'm going to say that what is unique about D&D is that it's a much more of a lifestyle oriented activity because it involves social connection and kind of symbols of dice and dragons and stuff like that, that are kind of signifiers of a tribal thing. It's like, oh yeah, I'm part of this tribe. I connect to this tribe. And I don't think those tribal affiliations disappear as quickly as fads do. So, you know, they're referencing it. They're referencing something that was cool and new half a century ago. I mean, think about that. They're coming out with these as part of the 50th anniversary. So, you know, I don't know if it will always increase at this pace. I don't know if you'll be able to get D&D Converse 5 years from now or 10 years from now. Uh-huh. But the fandom will just reform and it'll reconstitute itself in a different way, much like a set of Legos.
That's interesting how you bring that full circle.
Yeah, circle it right back.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think for example, a great example of this is the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? That brought comic books into absolute mainstream to the point where, like, if you mention Captain America to anybody, anybody knows who that is.
Yeah.
Right? Or Iron Man or something like that, right? And so I think like this kind of stuff is bringing D&D to kind of that social collective, status where like everybody knows what it is, even if they haven't played it or been engaged with it. Now you could argue that the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is ebbing and like people are starting to get tired of it. So we may not see nearly as many movies and things like that. Right. And maybe not nearly as many references and stuff like that, but it has kind of hit that high watermark in our social social fabric that you can't ever deny it ever again. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it won't ever recede into the depths of obscurity where it was maybe like in the 90s, like comic book geeks.
Yeah. You know, like Iron Man was a fringe character to make a movie out of. Iron Man, right. Sure. He's not a big deal, but now you say Tony Stark, everyone knows who Tony Stark is.
Yeah.
And that was not the case before the 2008 Iron Man movie.
So that's a good point. It's a good point that it's not going to probably fall into obscurity, but I think that it depends on the content that's in the medium that is consumed by the current mass generation. So like the Marvel Universe came out of obscurity. I would probably, some people argue it was never in obscurity, but the reality is for most people, it probably was. Because it was content that was accessible in a medium that people could consume and were already designed or were already trained to consume. I'll tell you this. I think that there probably was comic book sales, but I'll tell you probably 90% of people that have seen all the Marvel movies still don't read comics. I still don't think they read comics. Now.
Yeah.
I think they don't. Like all of my kids' friends, they've seen all the movies. They don't read comics. Like, I don't think
I 100% agree with you. And that's what I'm saying is like, it kind of reached a high watermark in our social fabric because of that. Right.
Yeah.
And you're right. Is the medium that did that. So I guess the more D&D movies we get, the better. Right.
Right. And so I think when the content moves away from that medium or when the medium changes, that's when I think we'll see a shift in whether or not D&D stays where it is. In terms
well,
of
what did what for kind of this time period right now, that you could argue is the golden age of TTRPGs right now. Maybe not the Gilded Age. You know, the Gilded Age is kind of that age of yesteryear, which I would say is the 70s and 80s. But, like, the Golden Age of RPGs is happening sort of right now. And what really, I mean, one of the things that really kicked that off was Matt Mercer's Critical Role show, right? And that really started hitting some mainstream stuff because during COVID, people were able to watch this on a medium that was accessible on YouTube, essentially. Right.
See, like I don't know. I don't know if it was Critical Role, man. I kind of feel like it was Stranger Things. It was the exposure to this thing in a culture that was in a medium that rising generation was already consuming.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. I would go with that. I agree. Yeah. I mean, I think Critical Role played a factor in it because I had daughter's friends telling me, like, oh, did you see the Critical Role episode about X, Y, and Z, and they haven't played.
Critical Role gave them a place to go after they got introduced to it.
I agree with that. Yeah. Yeah. I agree, Jason. Yeah, right. I think you're right. It was Stranger Things. Stranger Things definitely, like, opened the floodgate, and then they had places to go because of YouTube and
things. Like Stranger Things wasn't enough.
Yeah.
But then they could get into it on the live play shows, and then they could feel it out and say, oh, I know what this feels like.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting segue into our main topic, right? Good. Of like,
we're getting there.
Like card games, like Magic the Gathering, right? D&D versus Magic the Gathering. Like Magic the Gathering has not really ever had a huge opportunity, that game, that universe, to explode into a medium that the masses have been able to consume or have already been prepared to consume it on.
They tried. Right. There was ESPN.
Yep.
Sports
they tried for MTG sure yeah.
for a while, but it didn't stick, it didn't take, and it didn't increase in popularity. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but I think that's because
the Tabletop Sports Network or whatever.
But I think that's also because the only people that sought out that content were the people that knew about it and were looking for it.
Right.
Whereas like people, Stranger Things is a good example, right? Like people weren't looking for D&D. They were looking for a setting, an adventurous setting with young kids that came together and fought something. D&D happened to be introduced to them through that.
Right.
Right. If we had another Stranger Things where instead of D&D, it was the Magic the Gathering inside, do you think Magic would have a larger mainstream exposure?
I'm going to tell you why I don't, because I remember. I remember when Magic the Gathering broke up all of our RPG groups and everybody was mad at each other all the time. Because there was just too much enmity associated with the game when it came out.
It's hard.
And I don't think that enmity has ever fully ebbed from MTG. It's found its sweet spot with its audience, but when it came out and everybody stopped rolling up characters and we all started hating each other playing decks, I'm serious. It busted up a lot of RPG groups.
Yeah.
And it was ironic that Wizards of the Coast bought TSR because they had been, that's what was selling in the game stores was Magic packs. And they had the cash on hand because they were just printing their own money for a long time. So card games are great. Magic the Gathering opened up a new way of gaming, and it really created collectible card games. It really just set the standard. I mean, underneath the plastic bin I'm using as my ottoman, I probably have about 1,000 MTG cards from 1992 and 1993 and 1994 that I never play with. But they do a great job of weighing down this plastic tub as my ottoman. I still have them.
So, and this kind of brings us to our main topic, which is living card games, right? So you talked about sort of the collectible card games. But tonight we want to talk about living card games, and it's interesting because I'll be honest with you, even not too long ago, I would see CCG, LCG, and I'd just be like, oh, that's a card game that is very involved. I don't think I want to get involved in that, and I don't think I could be further from the truth. Like they're two very different kinds of games. They share some similarities, but their objectives are very different. So let's talk about what is a living card game. Like, what is that? What is that? When you hear living card game, what does that mean?
Well, what living card games did was break the model of I have to buy hundreds of dollars of booster packs and, you know, put common hundreds of stacks of commons aside and then look at uncommons and then rares and then super rares. A living card game, there was a list of cards every pack. You knew exactly what you were getting when you bought a living card game pack. And what you bought was the same as the guy sitting next to you bought. And it was a choice whether or not you wanted to buy those cards that you could identify in that pack. But there would be new packs coming out from time to time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, a collectible card game is very focused on competition, right? Like, you're going to sit across from your friend. You've collected all these cards that you can get. You have built your deck. You've looked for all the combos that you can do, and then you're kind of playing against each other. Classic collectible card games that we have talked about are Magic the Gathering. You've got Pokemon. You got Dragon Ball Z. You've got a whole bunch of these other games where you will, Star Wars Destiny came out. That's another one that is a collectible card game. Yeah. That you would, kind of play against each other and you would get certain packs and do that. But living card games a little bit different because you aren't playing against each other. Usually the games are either solo play or co-op.
Well, that's not entirely true. I think the main differentiator, and this is a good thing to talk about.
Yeah.
The main differentiator between a living card game and a collectible card game is kind of what Dan was saying. Living card games, you buy the set when a set comes out, and it's living, meaning there's usually releases and on a schedule. When you buy that set, you get all of the cards from that set. There's no like, am I, what's going to happen in this? Whereas a CCG is, it's a black package. You don't know what cards are in, right? It's a randomized thing. Like, that's the main thing about a CCG. Because like Netrunner, Android Netrunner was an LCG.
It started as a CCG, and then when it got to Fantasy Flight, they converted it into
But it was LCG. Absolutely still a competitive game when they took it, right? But when a new release came out, all of the cards were set on the list. They were all in the box. So when you bought that box, everybody got the same cards when they bought that box.
And let me tell you what that does. Is it number one, it removes luck out of your – you can throw money at a game, and you're not relying on luck to get to a strategic – deck that you want for the game. The other thing that it really, really does is it completely eliminates the secondary market for individual cards.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And that is a huge deal. That's a huge differentiator because you could be sitting on a stack of cards and some of them are worth hundreds of dollars or do you sell it? Do you get rid of it? Do you use it? Why is it worth more? Is it more powerful? Do you need to get other cards for that card to work? And CCGs have all those inherent problems in them.
Yeah, some
people love that about them. It's not necessarily a problem. That's a unique part of CCG.
That's true.
Yeah.
That secondary market is what keeps a lot of game stores alive, by the way. Like, most of the game stores I go into, they've got the shelves and shelves of like buy and sell the Magic the Gathering cards, right? And it's like, that kind of buy-sell churn that happens in the store is actually what keeps a lot of them open.
Hey, in 1993, I knew where every secondary Magic the Gathering card store was in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And I would go from store to store looking for Black Nightmare horse, flying trampoline horses called Nightmares, because I needed to get four for my deck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they were steep. To buy them individually, but I did.
Yeah, I was going to say that there's a slight overlap there because some LCG decks that come out or sets that come out, there is a limited number of certain cards in there that start to become very valuable that you could build a deck of.
Yeah,
but a lot of print maybe. Yeah, but a lot of the LCGs adjust that by having stricter rules on like how many of a certain card you can have in your deck. Right, like Magic the Gathering used to always be you can only have four of this card in your deck.
Four cards,
right? And there are always exceptions, but Netrunner, as an example, has, you know, you can only have two of this card in your deck. So even if you went out and bought like a whole second box, you can still only put two. So that card's only going to be worth so much money.
Yeah.
In there. Yeah. It would be interesting, and Dan, I'm curious on your thoughts on this, the difference between CCG, LCG, and TCG. The LCG, TCG get a little confusing sometimes. Living card game, trading card game, collectible.
Trading card game. I think I think TCG and CCG are kind of synonymous because the C in CCG is collectible. So you're trading out the word collectible for trading. Some games, the trading is kind of a bigger deal than the actual gameplay.
That's the key, I think.
I'm going to say, from my limited experience with Pokemon, I would probably throw it. I know it's a perfectly decent game. I played it with my son. But at the same time, there's other reasons to collect those cards that have nothing to do with building out a strategic deck to win a game.
Yeah,
you're like trying to, you know, you've got your favorite things that you're, you know, you're trying to complete sets. It's more like maybe collecting like sports cards where you're like, oh, I need to get the whole team.
Yeah, you're right. And I think that's a CCG and an LCG. And this is where there's probably some fuzziness. I think a CCG or an LCG could both be a TCG or have that trading card game aspect to them if a lot of the game and the culture of the game was built on trading cards to try to adjust what you have, your collection and your deck. It just depends on what the owners of the game really kind of want to do with their cards.
Once you remove the stress of, did I get a good pack?
You're right. Yep.
I living card games became an antidote to everybody that got really turned off by Magic the Gathering.
Right.
It was like the publishers were like, stop hyperventilating. You can buy this game and play it.
Yeah.
If you want to buy more card packs, here they are. We're going to come out with some more stuff. Chillax and play the game and have fun instead of hyperventilating and saying, do I need to be chasing a particular meta? And I remember being in card stores in the 90s where people would come in and say, hey, I want to get into this game. What does it cost to play competitively? And the card store guy would say, yeah, you're going to look at, this is in 1993 money. Yeah, you're going to put down about $2,000 to get this game going for years if you want to play competitively. And I never spent that kind of money and I never played competitively, but I always thought that was kind of a jerk thing to say to a potential new player.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. I mean, obviously, CCGs, they need to tell them it costs $25 this week and then $25 next week. And
yeah, you just got to slowly roll.
You got to keep coming back to my store. I'll have a new pack for you.
Yeah.
But I think TCGs and LCGs typically are grouped together, and CCGs kind of stay out there by themselves. Because there's not really a lot of trading in CCGs. There's more just, like you said, that secondary market to build your deck.
See, I disagree. I actually think TCGs and CCGs are together, and LCG is separate.
We're going to have to disagree on this because I think the community sees TCGs as there's no randomization in the cards. Everybody knows what the cards are that you have. Everybody has access to them, and then it's just about trading the cards to get what you want out of it.
You see that with the Pokemon kids and kind of the Dragon Ball Z.
But exactly.
They really enjoy the trading as part of the fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, but a Pokemon and a Dragon Ball Z is a CCG as well.
It is. I think we're.
But I think it's a TCG.
We're getting lost in semantics.
Yeah. Sure. Semantics are fun, though. That's what the English language is all about.
We're nerding out on stuff we don't spend enough time playing. Yeah. That's for sure.
Okay, so let's talk about, you know, so you've got some LCGs, living card games, that are kind of out on the market right now that you can play. Some that come to mind are Arkham Horror, the card game. Legends of the Five Rings is another one. What are these games about? Like, if I were just to pick up Arkham Horror, the card game, I'd be thinking that it's like Arkham Horror, the board game. Which, is it similar? Is it different? Like, you know, I mean, ironically, I think in Arkham Horror, the card game, there's still less cards than in Arkham Horror, the board game, you know, because there's so many darn cards in that Arkham Horror, the board game. But, you know, it's a card game. So, like, what is it? Like, what is this about?
I own it. I don't play it enough. I'm waiting for someone.
So, how does it work? Like, how does, like, Arkham Horror, the board game, like, how does it work?
Game?
Or, sorry, the card game.
Okay. All right. That's what was confusing me because you're like, the board game. Sorry. I was like,
Yeah. Arkham Horror, the card game.
Yeah.
How does it work?
Okay. Arkham Horror, the card game, is a cooperative living card game.
Oh, well.
By the way, FFG has registered.
Read the internet.
LCG, LC Living Card Game is a registered trademark, is a registered thing by Fantasy Flight Games. So,
wow.
So
LCG is registered by Fantasy Flight? Really?
Yeah.
Yep. Set a bit of backdrop of Lovecraftian horror as the ancient ones seek entry to our world. One or two investigators, up to four with two core sets, work to unravel arcane mysteries and conspiracies.
Yeah.
All right. In practice, Jason, how does this game work?
it's in practice, it is almost like a board game where you grab a deck of cards that is the story deck, uh-huh. right? And it's already set up. Like, there's a booklet that comes with that deck of cards that says, this is how you set up this act, this is how you set up the next act, and all that stuff. Yeah. But what makes it a little bit more than just playing a board game that I think is really cool is rather than you just saying, okay, let's play this board game, and I'm going to pick Susan, you're going to pick Gerald, and you grab Gerald's, I grab Susan's card and you grab Gerald's card. I can bring my own deck from my own investigator from a completely different set, and I can actually tweak that deck based off of rules for building that investigator's uh-huh. deck. And then I come to your house with I bring snacks, right?
That's true.
But I bring snacks and I bring my little deck. And this is a deck that I formulated, putting extra cards in, taking some cards out that I wanted for my investigator. And that's what I bring to the table. And we both set up and play that story with my investigator that you built or that I built and your investigator that you built, independent of the story itself. And that's, I think, what's cool about it. But at the end of the day, you're just playing through the story and it's presenting locate just kind of like all the Arkham games, you know, whether it's Arkham Horror, the board game, or what was the dice Elder one Science. Called? Anybody remember what the dice Arkham game was called from Fantasy Flight as well? I don't remember, but they're all based off of locations. Every card or everything you do, you're going to some special location, whether it's in this universe or in a different plane. And you're looking for clues and fighting monsters in those locations and trying to close gates and all that stuff.
Yeah, one of the things that I liked, so Jason, you and I played this about 2 weeks ago, right? One of the things that I liked about playing this is it almost was like a DM-less RPG in a sense, mm-hmm. right? Like, it had a story that was guiding you through it, and then it basically said, okay, you've come to this point, now you need to complete these tasks.
Yep.
And in those tasks, there's kind of an artificial timer that's happening, right? They have like a doom mechanic that happens that like you have to put this doom token on a thing and it sort of moves the story forward and you got to do it quickly or if you don't, then things happen, you know? And so the story's moving forward and you're just kind of reacting to what's happening in there and you're working together to solve it. And like Jason said, I can use an investigator pack. It has a set from the starter deck, or I could go get a separate one that's out there and use that deck. And so it offers a lot of replayability in that sense of like, okay, well, you know what? Like, we played this on hard mode and we really failed badly to the point where like we kind of died. Let's try it with another deck that might be stronger at combat this time, or another deck that might be better at like finding clues or something like that. And you can just kind of play in different ways. The story is sort of branching in the sense of like it can go to like option A, option B, option C, depending on like how well you did in accomplishing your task. But what I did like though, Jason, is that, and I don't know how other stories are, but you know, I'm talking about Arkham Horror in particular. It kind of failed forward. Like if you failed at something, like you would still progress in the story, but there'd be consequences in the next act.
Like the what was it? The ghoul priest gets shuffled back into the deck so that he will come up again later and cause you problems.
Yeah, because if you didn't kill him in the first act, or something like that. So, so it was really good. And you know, the thing that shines, like where you really start to enjoy the game, is when you start to fully understand and embrace the deck building aspect of it. right? And you're given rules with your investigator about like how you like here are the parameters of the deck that you need to set up.
Yeah.
But then you can kind of go in and put in like, okay, well, I didn't use a lot of these rations. That's just not something I need that gives me supplies. I'm going to take a bunch of those out, but I am going to put in a bunch of flashlights because that'll help me like get clues. You know,
and you level up, pull those up.
Yeah, and you level up and you get better versions of the cards and things like that. So, yeah, I think that it's fun because you are playing a co-op game. I mean, this is kind of the FFG model, right? You're playing a co-op living card game that kind of like a DM-less story. So you're sort of role-playing, but I mean, there's not a lot of role-playing. There's not role-playing at all, really. Well, I mean, you can if you want to.
Yeah, you know? If you want to.
But it's just fun. Like, you go to a new location and you read the flavor text about it, and it kind of gives you like a little bit of like feeling and mood about like what's going on. And then, like, you know, we ended up having like a really good, we ended up having a really interesting thing. And then we got to the text and we found out that like blackmail was involved with some people, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff that was happening with other people. And it was just really fun to kind of like dig into it. You're like, oh, geez, that's not good, you know? And just, it was really interesting. It was like reading a story, almost like kind of had a choose your own adventure-y feel.
It was very much choose your own adventure feel for sure.
Yeah. You know, so
yeah,
it was a lot of fun like that. So, very different vibe than like if you were to take a deck of cards to a Magic the Gathering tournament, where you're like opposed,
yeah,
you know, and stuff like that. So,
put a shift on this and talk about like Android Netrunner too, because that is an LCG if we use Fantasy Flight's term, but it's one that is competitive. And where that one's a great game because it's an asymmetric game. Like there, one person is playing the corporations, the other people are playing the hackers. And it's the same thing, right? There's not a story necessarily that's driving that, but you can both bring your own decks to the table that have rules to build your deck from. It's not randomized cards. They're out of the exact same box.
Uh-huh.
But there are extra cards that you can like swap in and out. Like that way, if I come as a hacker, I can kind of tweak my deck a little bit. And then when I'm playing against you, you're playing against a little bit different of experience, but it's not a crazy different experience where there's like a meta and all that stuff that, you know, you're having to be prepared with. And it's still the same style of gameplay, the asymmetric, gameplay every time. There's just a little bit of tweaks, there, and it's still very thematic inside of the Android universe, the concept that you're trying to break, you know, trying to use ice to break through, use icebreakers to break through security levels, to get into the corporation's assets, to gain their assets and get their accounts. The corporation's trying to cause brain damage to the hacker and all this stuff. So I think that living card games have a little bit better of a feeling of balance. Because everybody knows the cards. There's not like this, it's not a pay to win model.
Yeah.
You know, and there's not really a meta to chase, I feel like. And that could be through just the design of the game. It could also just be an artifact that falls out when all of the cards are exposed to everyone from day one.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not chasing that elusive combo that's going to get you a win, right? Like, you may find interesting combos that help you, but anybody can get that if you're all playing.
Anybody can use them. They're accessible to everybody on day one.
And it's much easier to quantify chasing that meta. You're like, oh, okay, I got to go get, there's only one of this card in every pack, and I want seven cards, so I got to get seven packs, and I got to go find them, and they're in demand.
Yeah.
That's a different problem than a collectible card game or a trading card game. Fun fact, Star Wars is, they just came out with a new trading card game, yep, not a living card game, uh-huh, called Sparker Rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And so FFG is getting back into the booster pack thing. And I am on a website where they have cards currently trading. There's a Boba Fett card trading for about $800. And this game's been out just a few weeks.
Yeah, I was looking when we were having our little hot debate there. I was looking a little bit, and you know, you can go through all the different, you know, Reddits and stuff to try to figure it out. But it seems like there's a general feeling that the word TCG was generated to avoid the negativity around a CCG, but effectively could be the exact same thing.
That's interesting. I like it. A rebrand, basically.
Yeah,
right?
A rebrand.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is funny because if you think about Magic the Gathering versus Pokemon, you're like, Magic the Gathering, like, Pokemon, you're like,
Yeah. Or the My Little Pony card game. Remember that one?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, I've got, I bought that for my kids.
Yeah.
Still have it in the house somewhere.
That's funny. So I'm on Fantasy Flight's website right here. I pulled it up for everybody. And here's a living card game, right? You can see that they've got a whole bunch of different offerings for living card games. And so what is interesting about the living card games is some of them aren't living anymore, by the way. Some of them are very dead.
Right. Very dead.
Very dead.
Like, for example, the Call of the Cthulhu card game. I just want to go to that real quick and just kind of show you.
And that was an adversarial game, too.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, that was a competitive game.
Here's a Call of Cthulhu core set out of print, right? And then the deluxe expansions are all out of print. So I think it's funny that they pretty much listed on there. They've got a couple of, like, expansions that, like, probably never sold that, they're just trying to sell. But it's interesting because, like, Call of Cthulhu, the Star Wars one is in the same...
That is a long out-of-print game, Star Wars one.
You can still get a Rey and BB-8, but...
No. Those are the sleeves.
These are just
the sleeves? You can still get the sleeves, but the card packs have been in bargain discount bins over and over and over again. The nice thing about a living card game, the way that FFG designed it, was that if you want to get into a time machine and buy a 10-year-old card game, you have a list of all the expansions, and you could probably go find them all unopened and... And actually have a collectible card game. You can collect all the expansions and know that you're done.
Which is
much, much more difficult in the other model.
Except this Arkham Horror one is like the most confusing like box set thing ever.
Yeah. So to explain Arkham Horror a little bit, they living card games, by the way, you'll come out with a core box and then essentially, you know, a year later, they'll come out with an expansion, right? And they call that a cycle that they do. And in that cycle, they'll come out with several portions of that, right? There's probably a story portion. There's a couple of and I'm going to use Arkham Horror as an example. There's the campaign, and then there's like a whole bunch of investigator packs that you can get, and then there's a couple of standalone adventures that you can get, and that's all part of one cycle that happens in that year, right? So it's almost like a season in a sense. And then the next year, the next cycle comes out. So here we have our starter decks, right? Well, actually, it's not even that. Here's your right here, the core set right here. You can then go ahead and buy additional starter decks if you want. But actually, and these ones, like you played with Stella the other day, right,
yeah.
Jason?
Yep.
Yeah, so these are starter decks that you can get that are not part of the original the core set. And these are what's awesome about these, though, is you pull it right out of the pack and you're good to go. Like, you're ready to play pretty much. You might have to pull out a couple of cards to get your deck ready, but, like, there's not a lot to it, right? You have everything you need in that for that investigator. But the very first cycle that came out was the Dunwich Legacy. And you can see here, like, all this kind of stuff that it has here. And this is actually even more streamlined from what it was before, because you had, like, the Investigator expansion and the Legacy Campaign expansion. This is the new, like, packs that used to be, like, and it had, like, a whole bunch of other stuff that was in there. They kind of consolidated all the investigators that were part of the cycle into one box, and they consolidated all the adventures that were sort of separate into one box. So now you just have to buy these two things and you get all of this stuff as part of it, you know, in there. So Yeah. So what's great, as you said, Dan, is that you can go onto like FFG here and I can see like, oh, look, here is right here all of the different cycles that they have done. And I can now go look on eBay or Craigslist or Facebook Marketplace or wherever I can try to find maybe some used versions of these if I can't find them in print anymore. And I know that I can collect them 100% if I really wanted to, which is great. You're never going to get that feeling trying to do a Magic the Gathering. You know,
yeah, like, unless you want to take out a second mortgage on your house.
Right. So the living card games that Fantasy Flight is still continuing right now is, I believe, Game of Thrones is still in print. I'm pulling it up just so that we can see it. Oh, no, it is out of print. Yeah, it's all out of print. So Game of Thrones is all out of print, which is kind of a bummer. Arkham Horror is still in print. They're still doing stuff. Cthulhu is out of print. Legend of the Five Rings is still in print, I believe. And I hear it's pretty...
That is such an interesting franchise, The Legend of the Five Rings. Yeah. It's like there's this special group of people that are like deep into that stuff. And they're consuming everything they can get in every medium type they can.
Oh, totally. It has a very...
It's like a cult following inside of a cult hobby.
Yeah, it's so true. Lord of the Rings card game is still very much living. In fact, I was talking to our friend John about this the other day. He was getting some packs for that. And Star Wars, the card game, is dead. Dead as a doornail.
Yes, but there's a new one that's collectible or trading, rather.
Yep, exactly. So, but I mean, again, if you're really interested in doing the Game of Thrones living card game, I bet you can find almost all of it like for a reasonable price on eBay
or Miniature Market. I got all of my Arkham stuff off Miniature Market.
Yeah.
Because they try to push inventory all the time and they still have living card game stuff on their shelves or whatever warehouse.
Yeah, I mean, you can get Game of Thrones, a living card game, second edition on Amazon right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Look, the Arkham Horror, that camera knows when to fuzz out, doesn't it? Arkham Horror game, it is a fun game. It is not a short game, though.
Right.
It's a difficult one, meaning you're going to have to put your heads together like a lot of co-op games and try to figure out how to solve it and kind of strategize, but it's very thematic, meaning it really feels like a choose your own adventure a little bit as you're playing it. You feel like you're reading a horror novel while you're playing the game.
Yeah.
Which is great if you're into that. If you just want to roll dice and like win the game, you probably could play it that way too and not read the text, just flip the card over and look for the next, you know, five clues you got to get. You could play it that way too, but you're really going to get the magic out of the game by reading the flavor text and diving into the lore that's around it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if there is a game that, you know, you want to try in terms of like, hey, I want to get with a buddy. All of these are like usually 1 to 2 players. Arkham Horror can be 3 to 4 if you get 2 of the base core set, which is great. I mean, Jason, you and I have 2 of it, so we could have 4 people while we're playing, right?
Yeah.
So you can play 4, which I think would be very interesting. But if you want to get together and just have a really good time playing a little game that takes a little bit to set up because you got to get the decks figured out.
It can actually take a lot to set up.
Yeah.
If you don't know the symbols.
Once you get to know the symbols, though, like when we set up the second adventure, it actually was really quick.
Yeah.
That's it.
I'll tell you, though, this is one of those games where there's like 7 symbols on every card mean like different things. And every time I probably play this game once a year. And so I don't remember all of the symbols. And so I've got to crack the book open just to figure out how to set the game up, like every time I play it.
Yeah. That's fair. Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. But I mean, listen, we played Arkham Horror the card game. I thought it was great. you can get pretty good deals on Miniature Market if you keep your eyes open. I got the, so they have the revised core set out right now, which actually is like two boxes put into one, two of the old versions put into one, so that you can play 3 to 4 players out of the revised core version.
Yep.
But if you want to get just a stand, like if it's just you and one other buddy, or you're just going to get your own set, you can find it for like $8 sometimes. So, like, what a great way to try out a game for $8. So, yeah, if you're interested in that, I highly recommend it. So, yeah. Anything else to add, gentlemen, on the Living Card Games?
No, I think we should, you know, we should be playing more card games. You know, we in the group, we own a lot of them. I just don't think they get the same play as some of our other stuff, just because we're spending too much time role playing, as always. So we needed to like break out and do other types of games. And so I'm a fan of, look, I have Arkham Horror on my shelf. Can you guys teach me how to play it? Because I tried to teach myself on a cruise ship once and I was like, nope, I'm done. I'm under the pool.
It's funny. I actually played Arkham Horror on a cruise ship.
I think I heard that once. Yeah.
I'm happy to play it with you. Like, I had a great time doing it.
It's a fun game. I like it a lot.
Yeah, and Jason's got one of the expansions, so we could just like play it.
I have an expansion, and I have like three of the extra investigators spread across all of the different seasons.
So if you were going to get like one of those, should you just randomly get packs if you already have the core set? Or is there risk in buying the wrong thing?
So there is risk in buying the wrong thing, because a lot of times you'll get sales on the older, when the game, like Justin was showing you, maybe Justin, you can go back to the seasons that were there. Today you can pay like somewhere around $60 to $70 to get the full season of story. But a lot of people are trying to push off of their shelves the little mini packs that were released like one by one as a season was progressing. Like those little ones right there. They're like 16 or 17 like bucks.
So this came out back in the day. The Dunwich Legacy was like the expansion. And then you'd have the Miskatonic Museum, the Essex County Express, Blood on the Altar, like all of these little things that came out separately. And you had a whole bunch of separate investigators that came out separately as well. Yeah. So what they've done is, because it was getting very, very confusing about when was released and what and everything like that, they lumped them all together. And so you now have the Dunwich Legacy Investigator expansion and the Dunwich Legacy Campaign expansion. And so the Investigator one has all the investigators for that cycle.
So do you have to buy both boxes to get the full...
If you want the full experience for that season, you got to buy both boxes. But you never need the investigators.
You can never need the investigators.
Use any investigator from any season in any season.
Yeah, I could use my starter box investigators if I wanted to play in this expansion. Assuming they're still alive, yeah. It doesn't hurt at all. Like, you can play those no problem. And so... it's just, do you want extra investigators to play with? And some people do, you know?
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
A great, if you scroll all the way to the bottom, there's a separate adventures or standalone adventures. So here are some packs you can get that are just all by themselves. They're like self-contained arcs. And they're pretty, you know, they're typically, they're about like $17 to $22. But it's a great, like, once you get through the starter set, if you just want to have like a self-contained, like, I just want to explore another story without getting like $80 into another expansion.
Yeah.
This is a good one. Because a lot of times you may think, oh, I'm just going to get one of those other little packs and play that. But that's like 2/3 of the way through a story. So you're going to like kind of mess your story up if you care about story stuff. This is a self-contained thing that you could play by yourself.
And a lot of these ones here are the ones that you're going to see sales on Miniature Market too.
Yeah.
Like the $16 one, you can probably get for $8 during one of their main sales.
Yeah.
So do you have to worry about the, it's all one game though. They've come out with different releases, but not necessarily editions though.
Nope.
You're not like,
no,
have a first edition problem, second edition problem.
Nope.
No. Editions are the same. It's just repackaging for simplicity.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So, but cool. Man, let me tell you though, it took me diving into Reddit for a while to try to figure out what the crap was going on with all of the releases, because you'd see like, you know, like, here's this expansion, but no, this is the Legacy Investigator expansion.
Yeah.
And you're like,
but if you have this box, then you don't need this one, this one, and this one. You need to buy this one, this one, and this one to complete the set.
And you're like, what am I looking at? But once you kind of understand it, then you're like, okay, I get it now. But anyway, a lot of fun. Check it out. And, you know, keep your eye on Miniature Market, because you can get really good deals on their sales as we're trying to get out. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Cool.
All right. Well, listen, everybody, thank you so much for listening to us tonight. We hope that you enjoyed learning more about Living Card Games, which is, again, trademarked by FFG. That was something new that I learned.
Yeah.
Today
we've learned together
every day.
Exactly. So but we hope you enjoyed it. If you liked it, hit the like and subscribe button for us. Jump in and talk to us about your LCG experience in our Discord down below. We'd love to hear from you and love to talk to you about it a little bit more. So thank you all, and listen, we will see you all at the tables. Have a good night.